We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. I started this a couple of weeks ago. I gave you the exposition of that section. This is the first part of the chapter anyway, dealing with the issue of lawsuits, taking brothers to court outside the church. And Paul gives some very specific definitions and instructions concerning that particular problem. Now, when I was here, I gave you, just an exposition of the passage. I really made no application except at the end of my discussion. I made a statement something like this: the Scripture is explicitly clear, and there is no disputation, and I will challenge any of you to show me that I have interpreted that passage incorrectly. The passage is clear. The problem comes in application. And that is where I called our brother Tim Farr to give me a little help here. And he spoke to you 2 weeks ago now. I was not here. I'm not exactly sure what he said. I've been approached saying, you agree with Farr, or you and Tim don't agree. So I don't know. One of us was not clear. I really haven't said anything yet. So Tim was the one who was not clear, apparently. So I'm going to give it to Tim here for a few moments. He has some more things he wants to say. And again, I think you understand that the problem of this chapter is independency. Let's call the proverbial spade a spade here. If everyone was as lucid and as scriptural in church polity as we, there would be no problem in the application of this chapter. But with independency, where each church is its own little domain, it becomes a problem, certainly outside of an individual congregation, to exercise and apply this particular passage. So that's where I've called Tim, and he's going to come now and say what he has to say, and then I'll reserve any comments to clarify my position after.
As long as you're clarifying your position, not mine. For those of you who don't know, let me just mention that Mike and I have a good time. We've known each other for a good little while. Matter of fact, it goes back quite a ways, and my wife and I had a lot to do with Mike's sanctification. Mike and Sandy used to come down. Mike was finishing up his work at studies at school, and I was in Columbia, and there was a little church down there that needed someone to come down and preach, because I was having to do that at the time under some circumstances that I won't get into. And I talked to Dr. Neal, and Dr. Neal sent me Mike, and Mike and Sandy used to come down every Sunday. Every Sunday, Mike got fed carrots. Now, for those of you who know Mike, carrots are not his favorite. So I feel like the Lord was really dealing with him at that time, and we had a lot to do with it. And he did not. He never said, ate them, too. I mean, just ate them, never said a word, never said it through Sandra. She never came back. Hey, listen, Sue, Mike doesn't like it. Never a word. So I felt like that we had a lot to do with Mike's sanctification. From that respect, now I was much maligned last week. Dr. Barrett gets up and says, "You're getting a double treat this week. You came to hear Farr. Hey, I've got some good news for you. You've got a double treat." Well, I got to thinking about that. You know what he was really saying was, "You were getting a treat to hear me from hearing him to start with. You got a double treat to hear Ron Cook." I won't disagree with that at all. Although I don't think Mike intended it that way. And I started to say something, but I held my tongue, keeping with what Ron Cook had taught us, that the Lord would avenge his elect. Dr. Cook no sooner got started. Now, let me just tell you, I really appreciate Mike and his teaching. I really do, in spite of all the fun and whatnot that we have and the joking. Mike's a real scholar. And I consider him as such. He's got a gift in teaching the Word. But I couldn't help but think,
Dr. Cook gets up.
He's going along, you know, he was talking on biblical interpretation. He says, you know, the church's cry at one time was, deliver us from the power of the priest. He says, now, church's cry is, deliver us from the power of the scholar. So you just consider me your deliverance this morning, and we'll go from there. All joking aside, I do appreciate it. So I just thought I'd let some of you know who might not know that Mike and I go at one another periodically, and all in good fun and having a good time. All right, 1 Corinthians 6. Just a couple of things to review, and we'll open this up if you have some questions or comments. Again, our setting. Book was written to whom? To who? To the church at Corinth, okay? A particular group of believers. And just as Mike mentioned to start with, here we had a church, even if I give you that we had two or three churches in Corinth. I think Scripture is very clear that the early churches, even in diverse places, in other cities, all were under one head. We had a good form of Presbyterian government going then. So that discipline in one was undoubtedly carried out throughout the church in its entirety. All right? So, given that, we've got a situation there unlike today. As Mike mentioned, with our independency, there is no way to uniformly enforce discipline throughout the church in its entirety. All right, the other thing of review, what was our problem that the book of Corinthians here, this 1 Corinthians is addressing? Not just in this one particular place, but generally. I mean, Mike's repeated it several times over. Division in the church, okay? Now, let's make sure we keep that in mind as we take a look at it. Now, I'm not going to back up and go over what we went over last week. I think if you have a question, we'll try to answer that. But I want to pick up with verse 7. Okay? Obviously, we've got a lawsuit going on. And I think verse 7, now therefore, there is utterly a fault among you because you go to law one with another. Why do you not rather take wrong? Why do you not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? In verse 8, nay, you do wrong and defraud, and that's your brother. Now, before I get into that, last week I asked how many felt like you could sue a Christian brother. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hands again. How many felt like you never could sue a Christian? And the majority were undecided. I am going to ask, did anybody change their mind after last week? And don't be afraid or embarrassed to raise your hand. Did anybody come to a conclusion after last week who was undecided when we started? All right, so we're wide open today. Good. All right, verse 7. Now, we've got our lawsuit going. Verse 7, the middle of the verse. Why do you not rather take wrong? Why do you not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? What's the implication? Put it in our lawsuit connotation. Okay? I'm going to sue Mike. Mike and I are the parties in this thing. Okay? I'm going to sue Mike. Now, remember one thing. I told you last week, and I haven't changed my position on that. I think the passage is very clear. Two believers, same church, you better be very careful. I think you've got to follow through here and with the other passage in Matthew. I think you've got to go to them. I think it needs to go through the church. Okay? We're even though I'm using this as our illustration, Mike's just visiting today. He's a member of another church for my illustration, okay? Or I'm a member of another church and he can stay here. I won't kick him out that quickly. All right, but I'm suing Mike. Now, what's the implication here? Who is right, humanly speaking, between us? Who's right? I'm suing Mike in the passage. Okay? Why do ye not rather take wrong? Why do ye not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? Who's right? I'm right. I have a legitimate right to sue him. Continuing on, is there any question that Mike's wrong according to the scripture, this passage? No. What's he doing? He's defrauding me. He's defrauding me. The passage says, why don't you go ahead and be defrauded? So there is no question but what? Mike's doing me wrong. This is not a gray area thing where maybe he's right, maybe I'm right. This one's going to a clear, cut and dry, black and white, right and wrong. Mike's wrong, I'm right. I've got a right to sue him. All right? So, let's go on to verse 8. Nay, ye do wrong and defraud. Now, who's he talking about in verse 8 that's doing the defrauding? He's talking about me. But we just established in verse 7 that it's not me that's doing the defrauding, it's Mike. But now 8, he says, ye do wrong and defraud, and that's your brethren. Now, who am I defrauding? Am I defrauding Mike? No, I'm not defrauding Mike. He's defrauding me. So as between us, verse 7 puts us in our proper perspective here, our rightful positions. But 8, I would submit to you, comes in and says, now wait a minute. You've got a right. 7, I think, says you have a right to sue him. Okay? 8 says, but you better watch the consequences to the church. What's our problem we're dealing with? Division in the church. And Paul says, fine, sue him. But buddy, if you divide the church in doing it, you're going to be held accountable to God for it. Okay? I think it's very simple there. I told you last week, down in verse 12, and this is not uncommon for Paul, all things are lawful unto me, but all things are not expedient. And I think Paul there again is saying, sure, far go ahead and sue him. It's lawful to sue him. There's no problem with your suing him. But it may not be expedient for you to do it. And the expediency deals with my relationship to the church, the church's relationship to the world. There's a testimony going on here. And Paul's dealing with it. Do you have a comment, Doug? Okay. When I said I have a right, from the standpoint of forgetting about the actual suit, my main object there was to point out, it's good, my main object was to point out that between us, he was wronging me, humanly speaking. Okay? Humanly speaking, I have a right to sue him. Okay? That was my point, was to draw to make the point that there was very clearly here a right and wrong. Okay? And that humanly speaking, scripturally, spiritually speaking, there was a right and wrong, I think. But humanly speaking, I had a right to sue him. We'll get on to the spiritual side of suing him in just a minute. Okay? Alright. Anybody got any other comments or any disagreement or thoughts on where we are so far? All right. Now, having said that, I would submit to you that Paul in this passage has no intention as such to dealing with suing a Christian brother in and of itself. any more than Paul cared whether some wanted to follow Apollos' teaching or some wanted to follow somebody else's teaching? He didn't mind. He didn't mind if you wanted to be of one persuasion as opposed to somebody else. And I don't think Paul here is getting into the matter of lawsuits as a topic in itself. I think what Paul is basically doing here is taking a wide spectrum of problems that can cause divisions. Everything from the spiritual as to the teaching and training in the church, problems that arise in the church itself, problems that come out of the secular world, very much so in and of themselves. But he's gone through various things here, saying that, wait a minute, folks, there are divisions in the church. And I think what he's saying is, I don't care what it comes from. I don't care if it comes from the most innocent and the most spiritual. I mean, doctrinal teaching is extremely important. And these people were dividing over perhaps not so much the teaching in and of itself, although I think some of that was involved in interpretation of some of that, but they were getting hung up on who was the better. You know, is my dad better than your dad? Again, same thing we've been warned about by Mike, by the minister. You know, what do we do today? I go to faith. We've got much better teaching doctrinally than anybody else in town. Well, I don't know that I disagree with that. But if we take that and make it a point of division among the church in general, because whether we want to admit it or not, there are folks in churches this morning that have a label other than Presbyterian on them, much less Free Presbyterian, that are our brethren and part of the same body that we're part of. And if we cause division because of our label, we're guilty of what Paul was writing to the Corinthian church about. Now, granted, he was dealing with a local body, because that's where the problem was at that time. But again, the principle, let's not miss the principle for the setting. And I say all that to come over to the lawsuit matter. Let's not blow the setting out of proportion. Let's make sure we've got the principle. And I'm just saying the setting that Paul has given for us here is just another example. Paul is not out to lambast attorneys or courts, judges, or anything else here. Believe it or not, there are a couple of passages in Scripture that speak favorably of attorneys. Don't have a lot to say about them, but I say that in my defense in light of what the pastor always says. You know, you folks are the low part of the earth, and Scripture never says anything, although he knows it as well as I. But you just be on the watch. Periodically you'll see that. But Paul here is not attacking the judicial system. The point I raised with you last time. Okay? Saved judge. Saved judge in the civil system. Was it okay to bring the suit before the saved judge? And again, the point was that when Paul talked about the unjust, he was talking about the system, as opposed to the civil system, as opposed to the ecclesiastical system that he had in place over here that was available to them. Not because all judges were unsaved, but because, wait a minute, here's our problem. Why would it have mattered to Paul if I sued Mike and got what was due me? Why would that offend him? Why would that offend anybody else?
It shouldn't. But if in the process I take this church and have them say, look, I know Mike Barrett. Mike Barrett does no wrong.
If Tim Farr sued him, something was wrong. And I've got another part who says, I know Tim Farr. And Tim Farr wouldn't sue Mike Barrett unless he was justified in doing it. And now all of a sudden, what have I done? I've split the church. Now, I may not split it wide apart. It may get by. And I would submit to you that Paul here is not trying to deal with just the problem of taking the church and going whammo to where we wind up with two churches instead of one. I think Paul is dealing with anything that goes to the unity of the church and the harmony of the church. And again, look at Paul's teachings. He's constantly praising the unity that he observes in places. He's constantly, I'm praying for you and for the brethren. Constantly in his teachings, there is, hey, we're working together. You got a problem. Let's deal with it and get it aside so that it does not hinder the work of the church. And I think that's what he's doing here. Now, that still leaves us with Matthew. Okay? Still leaves us with our provisions in Matthew. And let's just flip back there for a second. Any comments? Anybody? If you disagree with me, that's fine. I'll just quote Dr. Barrett on that. If you want to be wrong, you've got the right to be. No. All right, Matthew 18 begins with verse 15. And again, I'm not going to take the time to read down through it. You're familiar with it. And I have not had a chance to take a look and see the word trespass. Do you know right offhand what the word trespass is in verse 15? What I'm going to suggest to you is, and again, it's my opinion, that Matthew 18, now, I don't want to make the distinction between Matthew 18 and, say, 1 Corinthians 6, saying that in 1 Corinthians 6, if Mike was defrauding me, that it wasn't sin. Okay? But I think in 1 Corinthians 6, we're dealing with, Paul is dealing with, in my opinion, what is otherwise lawful that he has no problem with from a spiritual standpoint. So I'm dealing with that. Mike owes me money and he just won't pay me. Okay? It's nothing spiritual outside of the fact that he won't pay me what he knows he owes me. And there's nothing in that passage to suggest that there are extenuating circumstances that would justify his not paying me. So no spiritual connotation other than the side effects. Matthew 18, I think, perhaps deals with more so the spiritual. If your brother goes and starts gossiping about you, okay? Something that in slanders in our day and age is an actionable tort that you can sue for, but things that here, or maybe even the guy just comes up and slugs you. Okay, a physical assault, and granted, that's also bears a civil action, but there was nothing preceding the trespass in Matthew 18 that gave rise to a cause of action. In my example, Mike owes me money. He signed a note a year ago and said he would pay me. Okay? Matthew 18, I've Mike hadn't paid me.
So I go around and I start saying, you know what kind of person Mike Barrett is? Okay? Now once I do that, I think I'm trespassing in Matthew 18. And in that situation, that is a spiritual problem, pure and simple. And I think the idea of Matthew 18 is, it's a spiritual problem. Let's take care of it. And here's the way I want it taken care of. We don't need to make this a congregational matter from the outset. Maybe he's just gotten upset and said something he didn't mean to, or I got upset. I got mad. Mike wouldn't pay me. I said, I'll fix him. I'll destroy his reputation. I'll let everybody know what kind of person Mike Barrett is. I think you got Matthew 18 problems. In that case, Mike comes to me and says, look, yeah, I know I hadn't paid you, but it's not right for you to do this over here. Now, Mike's got a problem maybe in my example coming to me there because he's got a problem of his own because he's defrauding me to start with. But for this illustration, and given this problem, I think Mike comes to me and says, hey, that's not right. If we've got a problem between us, let's take care of it between us. But we don't need to do all this. You don't need to be going and talking to everybody about this problem. That's between you and me. And if I persist in talking to everybody about it, then we've got our scenario laid out. Now, I'm not going to suggest that Matthew 18 cannot be applied to the civil situation. I'm just suggesting that I don't think Paul or Scripture anywhere teaches as a principle that you must forego your civil rights in the name of Christianity. And if you want a basis for that, you go through Scripture and you take a look at the life of Christ and see the violent action he took against the Christians of his day. Driving the money changers out of the temple. Those money changers were Christians. They would have borne the title. People of that day would have observed them to be that in name, if not in action. But Christ didn't forego that so that the world would say, oh man, look at this. Man, I don't want any part of this kind of thing. The way they treat one another. But I think what Paul is teaching, and I think what Scripture teaches about lawsuits, is the principle. If you sue a Christian brother, it really goes to everything. You don't have to limit it to lawsuits. In dealing with a Christian brother or sister, you had better be very careful and weigh the consequences of that suit or that action, whatever it may be. Not only as to that particular Christian brother or sister, but as to the church in general. I don't have to cite you examples of what's gone on lately of those who carry the Christian label. Although, you know, we would have no part of them. But they've carried that label.
Baker. Swiper. Okay? You got these people.
And what do you hear constantly? Man, those guys have really done us a lot of harm. And we sit back and say, boy, they didn't get any more than maybe their just dues. Though I personally feel like one of them at least got more than his just dues. But again, the ramifications. We don't condone their sin. And we don't condone, we don't mind the judgment upon that sin. But I would submit to you that in those particular cases, God visited the judgment upon them, not man. The man was simply the after effects. But in that case, okay, in that case, and what I would suggest to you with Matthew 18 is that it gets to the point where if you don't judge, there is a problem with the testimony and the cause of Christ. The lack of discipline, and I would submit to you that that's what happened when Christ drove the money changers out of the temple, for example, which in my opinion was a judicial act. It was a trial, a sentence, and an execution, all in one fell swoop. But I view that as a judicial undertaking by Christ in purging the church in that particular instance. And I would submit to you that if there is not discipline, you have just as much harm and potential division as if there is a lack of it. You're still going to have it. Okay? Anybody got any comments? Like I said, you've got the right to be wrong. All right, let me ask you this. And let me say one thing. I don't know that...
Can I say one more thing?
Sure.
I do not disagree with your conclusion to this whole issue. I agree, but I think the way you've gotten it is to me, it's wrong.
Okay. All right, let me back up, because I'm not sure that we're necessarily disagreeing. I drew my distinction between a secular, if you would, illustration and a spiritual, only to draw where the distinctions can come, that is, that which grows out of what we would deem. I don't disagree that all things have spiritual ramifications to the believer, okay? But in my first one, it arose purely out of a secular transaction. In I'm suggesting in 1 Corinthians 6. Matthew 18, I am saying, grows in its origin out of what I will call a spiritual wrong. It is a there was nothing immoral about my loaning Mike money. That's what I'm saying, okay? That in the original transaction, it was secular in nature, and we're going to assume not immoral. Mike didn't tell me he wanted to go play the races or something and borrow money to do it, okay? And I wanted to draw that distinction so that in the original transaction, it even perhaps anticipated the right for me to sue him. It's not uncommon in a promissory note to say, if you don't pay, I have the right to sue.
And in addition to what you owe me in the notes, you have to pay for all the expenses I incur to collect it. Okay? It anticipated the suit, perhaps. Whereas in Matthew 18, there may be, in my view here, there is a wrong, a moral wrong at the outset. Now, again, I am not saying that Matthew 18 would not apply. In 1 Corinthians at all. And in fact, last week said that if you have believers in the same assembly, I think you've got to follow Matthew 18 when it gets to the point of your having gone to the person and it's clear. Now, let me make it a little tougher, though. Let's just say that there is no clear right and wrong. Mike thinks he's right, and I think I'm right. Okay, not quite so easy. Now, what do we do? I would even suggest to you that 1 Corinthians 6 may even forbid me coming to the church. Okay? 1 Corinthians 6 may even forbid me from coming to the church with a problem. Because if by coming to the church where there's no clear right and wrong, I cause division in that church through church discipline, I don't think it's any less wrong than if I went out here to the local court, sued the daylights out of him, and won. And cause division in the church. So the reason I made the distinction is it has become commonplace. Every time there comes any disagreement, you can't sue him. He's a Christian, you can't sue him. That's number one. Number two, you got to go to a church, to his church, to your church, to somebody's church. You know, let's go to the local priest anyway and get a ruling on this thing. But there's this theory that Christians can't sue one another. And some would say ever. Now, having said that, if in your heart you believe that a Christian cannot sue a Christian and you go sue somebody, it's sin to you. I think Scripture's clear on that. If you want to interpret it that way, I have no problem with that. All I am saying is I don't think Scripture mandates that interpretation. If you want to hold to that, if you walked in my law office and said, Mike Baird owes me money, but I can't sue him, I'm not going to try to get you to sue him. You say, I don't believe a Christian can sue another Christian. I'm not going to sit down and say, wait a minute, now somebody's led you down the primrose path on these passages. Uh-uh. Fine. But I'm saying, I don't think Scripture mandates that. And I think this is one of those places where we've taken an example in our efforts to define all right and wrong. And Mike's dealt with this before. It's one of the problems that Christianity, fundamental Christianity, has today is we have striven so to say this is right and this is wrong, and if you fall over here, you're in trouble. And miss the principles. All we want, tell me if it's right, tell me if it's wrong. It's wrong. I can't sue a Christian brother. Got it. Label that. Never sue a Christian brother. And then what do? You did what? You sued a Christian brother? You're a sinner. I better separate from you. Okay? That's my point. I've got no problem to what degree you want to take it. But I just don't think Scripture mandates it.
In many cases, they are
It's true. Condoning it. I mean, I would ask you the question. If we say you cannot sue a Christian brother, my next question is, can you report them to the police? If you know that they've committed a crime, do you have to go through the church? Number one. And are you forbidden flat out, if the church wants to report it to the police, it's up to the elders of the church or the preacher. Well, I would suggest to you that if you take Scripture and say that I can never sue a Christian brother, or my only recourse is to the church, then that may be where you're left. That may be where you're left. Are we past time?
Yes.
Well, I don't have a wife, so. All right. If you got any questions, you can ask Mike next Sunday. He now knows my clear application of the passage. He knows what's right now, how to apply it. He had the interpretation. Now he's got the application. He should be able to answer all of your questions next Lord's Day. All right. Thank you. You're dismissed, I suppose.